At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're getting into something fundamental: habits. We're looking at Charles Duhigg's work on the science behind why we do what we do automatically. You know, we like to think we're making conscious choices all day long, but a huge chunk of our lives, really most of it, is run by these ingrained patterns.
It really is, and the core idea is actually pretty elegant. Habits are the brain's way of saving effort. It automates the routine stuff so we can focus our mental energy elsewhere.
Right, like cognitive outsourcing.
Yeah.
And there's this incredible, almost unbelievable story about a man named Eugene that just perfectly illustrates this.
Oh, Eugene's case is fascinating. He had this illness, viral encephalitis, and it damaged a very specific part of his brain, the basal ganglia.
Okay, and the basal ganglia is what exactly?
Think of it as the brain's autopilot center. It's ancient, deep inside. And when his was damaged, well, the consequences were profound.
He lost his memory.
He lost the ability to form new memories, couldn't recall what happened minutes ago. Much of his past was hazy, too. But, and this is the kicker, he could still perform complex routines.
Like what?
Like taking his daily walk. He could navigate his neighborhood, make all the right turns, get back home. But he couldn't draw you a map of the road. He couldn't even tell you why he was walking or where his house was if you asked him directly while he was out.
Wow. So the habit, the physical routine, was totally separate from his conscious memory system.
Exactly. The habit pathway located in that basal ganglia was intact. The action itself was preserved, even when the conscious mind was, well, offline for recall.
That's a big deal. It shows habits are running in the background.
Mm-hmm. It's what the research calls chunking. The brain takes a sequence of actions like backing the car out of the driveway and collapses it into one automatic routine. When the routine starts, brain activity actually decreases.
Because the basal ganglia takes over.
Right. It's running the script.
Okay. So if that automatic script is the routine, what's the overall structure? How do we map this?
It boils down to a simple loop, really. Three parts. First, there's the cue. That's the trigger. Could be a time of day, a place, an emotion, another person, anything that kicks it off.
Right. The cue triggers the routine. That's the habit itself, the action or thought pattern.
The chunked behavior.
Exactly. And then comes the reward. That's the payoff, the thing that tells your brain, hey, this loop, it's worth remembering and doing again.
Cue, routine, reward. Seems straightforward. But, I mean, if it's that simple, why is it so hard to start, say, a new exercise habit or quit a bad one? There must be something missing.
There is. That simple loop explains the mechanics, but it doesn't explain the power of habits. The missing piece, the secret sauce, is craving.
Craving. Okay, explain that.
It's not just about getting the reward. It's about the anticipation of the reward. That's what really drives the loop forward. Your brain starts to crave the payoff as soon as the cue appears.
Okay. And there was that monkey experiment, right? Julio?
Yes. The Julio study is classic. They taught him to pull a lever when he saw a shape on a screen to get a drop of juice.
The reward?
Initially, his brain activity spiked when he got the juice. Made sense. Pleasure center lighting up. But as the habit formed, something fascinating happened.
What?
The spike shifted. It started appearing earlier. Right when the cue, the shape appeared on the screen. His brain wasn't just happy about the juice, it was happy about the anticipation of the juice.
So the craving itself became the driving force, the expectation.
Yeah, precisely. The anticipation became intensely motivating. And that's what happens to us. Think about your phone buzzing. That little buzz is a cue. The craving isn't necessarily for the information in the notification itself. It might be a craving for distraction, for social connection, for novelty. And that craving kicks in before you even pick up the phone. That's the hook.
And wow, businesses are experts at building this in, aren't they? Like Pepsodent, you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. Pepsodent's massive success wasn't just because it cleaned teeth. Lots of products did that. Its edge was that intense, tingly feeling it created.
Which wasn't actually cleaning anything extra.
Nope. It was from mild irritants in the formula. But that tingle served as an immediate sensory reward. It created a craving for the feeling of clean, confirming the routine worked.
And Febreze too, right? It bombed at first.
It did, because it was originally odorless. It eliminated bad smells, but there was no reward signal. People weren't sure it worked. It only took off when they added a distinct, fresh scent.
Giving you that, clean feeling, the reward confirmation.
Exactly. It satisfied the craving for proof of cleanliness. And fast food chains, they are masters of this. McDonald's standardizes everything, the look, the smell, the process, so the cues are incredibly consistent.
And the fries.
Designed to meld almost instantly in your mouth, it shortens the gap between the routine, eating, and the reward, that hit of salt, fat, and starch, to almost nothing. It locks in the craving loop super tightly.
Okay, so this craving, this anticipation, makes habits really sticky.
Mm-hmm.
So how on earth do we change them? Can we just, you know, decide to stop, break the loop?
Well, the research is pretty clear on this. You can't really extinguish an old habit. Those neural pathways, they don't just disappear. They sort of lie dormant, waiting for the old cue.
So you can't destroy it. What then?
You have to overwrite it. This leads to what Duhigg calls the golden rule of habit change. Keep the cue, keep the reward, but replace the routine.
Okay, keep the trigger, keep the payoff, but swap out the middle part. Give me an example.
Sure. Let's take smoking again. The cue might be stress at work. The reward you're craving might be a feeling of relief or a momentary distraction or the nicotine rush.
You can't just eliminate stress from work.
Right. The cue is still there and you still crave that relief. So instead of the cigarette routine, you consciously insert a new routine. Maybe it's nicotine gum. Maybe it's 5 minutes of deep breathing. Maybe it's a brisk walk around the block.
Something that addresses the same cue and delivers a similar reward.
Exactly. You're hijacking the old loop with a new behavior.
But, you know, that sounds good in theory.
Mm.
What happens when things get really stressful? Doesn't the old habit just come roaring back?
Often, yes. That's the critical failure point. When you're under pressure, the new, weaker pathway can get overwhelmed by the old, deeply ingrained one. To make the change stick, especially under stress, you need something else.
Which is?
Belief. The research, particularly looking at groups like Alcoholics Anonymous, found that belief is crucial for weathering those moments of high stress or temptation.
Belief in what, though?
It can be belief in a higher power, like in Edelweiss' model, but it doesn't have to be religious. It can be a deep belief in the change process itself, or belief in a community or support group, or belief in your own ability to eventually succeed. It's something that provides hope and resilience when things get tough.
Like the Coach Dungy story with the Colts.
That's a powerful example. Tony Dungy coached his NFL teams by drilling incredibly simple automatic habits. He wanted players reacting based on ingrained routines, not complex thought, especially under pressure.
Less thinking, more doing.
Right. And his system was effective. They won a lot, but they kept faltering in the biggest moments, like the AFC Championship game. Maximum pressure. And the old, less disciplined habits sometimes resurfaced.
Until the belief piece clicked in.
Tragically, yes. After the devastating suicide of his son, the team experienced this profound shared crisis. It forged an incredibly powerful bond and a shared belief in each other, in the system, maybe in something bigger. That shared belief, born from tragedy, seemed to be the missing ingredient that finally let those ingrained habits hold firm under the intense pressure of the Super Bowl, which they then won.
Wow. So belief is the anchor for the new routine. Okay, that makes sense for individuals.
Yeah.
How does this scale? How do you change habits across a whole company?
That's where the idea of keystone habits comes in. These are specific habits that, when changed, start a chain reaction, spilling over and transforming other patterns.
Like a domino effect.
Sort of, yeah. They create small wins that build momentum and change the culture. They create new structures that help other positive habits flourish.
And the Alcoa example is the go-to here, right? Paul O'Neill.
It's a brilliant case study. When O'Neill took over Alcoa, a huge aluminum company, everyone expected him to talk about profits. Instead, his first speech was all about one thing, worker safety.
Which probably seemed odd to Wall Street.
Very odd, but it was genius. Why? Because safety was something everyone could agree on, the union, the executives, the workers on the floor. It cut across all the internal divides.
Okay, so it was a unifying goal, but how did it change other habits?
To improve safety dramatically, O'Neill had to implement new communication routines. For instance, any unit president had to report any serious injury within 24 hours and present a plan to ensure it never happened again.
That forces people to talk, to analyze, to plan.
Exactly. It forced managers to listen to workers. It streamlined communication. It rewarded people who identified problems and proposed solutions. Improving safety required changing fundamental organizational routines around communication and accountability, which naturally led to improvements in efficiency, quality, and ultimately profits. Safety was the keystone that unlocked broader change.
And we see this on a personal level, too.
Definitely. Think about weight loss studies. Sometimes researchers just ask people to start keeping a weekly food diary. Just write down what you eat.
Not even telling them what to change.
Right. But that simple act of tracking that keystone habit often leads people to spontaneously notice patterns. Wow, I eat a lot of snacks around 3 p.m. And then they start making changes on their own. The awareness sparks the change.
Or Michael Phelps and his visualization habit.
Yeah, his whole pre-race routine, visualizing the perfect race down to the smallest detail, that was a keystone habit for mental resilience. It kept him calm and focused, letting his physical training habits take over, even under immense pressure.
So these keystone habits build small wins, which feels good, reinforces the loop, and maybe strengthens something else. You mentioned willpower earlier.
Absolutely. These successes feed into our sense of self-efficacy, and they seem to strengthen what researchers call the willpower muscle. And studies showed this muscle is incredibly important, more predictive of academic success than IQ, for instance, like in the famous marshmallow test.
Right. The kids who could resist the marshmallow did better later on. But you also said willpower is depletable.
It is. It gets tired just like a physical muscle. There was that study, the Mervin study, right?
Cookies and the radishes.
That's the one. People who had to use willpower to resist delicious cookies and eat radishes instead, they gave up much sooner on a subsequent frustrating puzzle task compared to people who got to eat the cookies.
Their self-control muscle was fatigued from the earlier effort.
Exactly. But the good news is you can train it. And strengthening willpower in one area of your life, like sticking to an exercise plan, tends to spill over. It can improve your focus at work or help you manage your finances better.
So how do we use this finite willpower smartly, especially if we know it runs out?
The key strategy is planning for the inflection points, those moments of predictable difficulty, stress, or temptation where your willpower is likely to falter.
Like those patients recovering from surgery.
Yes, the hip and knee replacement patients. Recovery is painful, requires effort. The patients who were asked to write down very specific, mundane plans for how they'd handle the painful parts of rehab. When my knee starts aching during my exercises, I will take 3 deep breaths and call my daughter for encouragement. Those patients recovered much faster. They walked almost twice as fast as those who didn't write plans.
They pre-decided the routine for the tough spot. They didn't have to rely on depleted willpower in the moment.
Exactly. They automated the response to the difficult cue. Starbucks does this with their baristas, too.
And the latte method.
Right. For handling angry customers. Listen, acknowledge, take action, thank, ensure satisfaction. It's a pre-planned routine for a stressful cue. It means the barista doesn't have to burn precious willpower figuring out how to react when someone's yelling at them.
And there's another interesting detail, autonomy. Feeling like you have some control helps.
It really does. Studies showed that even small acts that give people a sense of control, like being asked politely if they would mind skipping the cookies, rather than just being told to prevent their willpower from depleting as quickly, or allowing employees input on designing their uniforms, that sense of agency seems to protect the willpower muscle.
Okay, so habits shape us. Willpower can be trained, but needs planning. What about bigger systems? How do habits work in huge organizations or even whole societies?
Well, organizations, much like individuals, run on routines. But these routines often emerge not from some grand rational design, but from informal truces and power dynamics between different groups or departments.
Like the Veterans Affairs example, building hospitals.
Yeah. The source material points out that sometimes a bureaucratic habit emerges where the cue is, we have money left in the budget. The routine is, build another hospital. And the reward isn't necessarily a better veteran care, but might be the department maintaining its budget or a politician gaining influence. The routine serves internal needs, not always the official mission.
And these ingrained organizational habits are really hard to change, right? Nelson Winter's theory.
Extremely hard. They argue these routines are incredibly stable because they represent a sort of equilibrium of interests. It often takes a major crisis, or at least the widespread perception of a crisis, to shake things up enough to break those routines and allow for change.
Like the King's Cross Station fire in London.
Exactly. A horrific fire caused by, among other things, ingrained habits of downplaying small fires and poor communication. Or the Rhode Island hospital incidents where surgeons operated on the wrong side of the brain. These terrible events created crises that finally forced changes in deeply embedded safety routines and power structures.
And this applies to social movements, too, how habits spread change across society.
Definitely. Movements seem to rely on different layers of social habits. They usually start through strong ties, our close friends and family. Think about Rosa Parks. She wasn't just some random person. She was deeply respected and connected within multiple community groups. Her act resonated through those strong ties first.
But for a movement to grow big, to really spread,
then you need weak ties. These are our acquaintances, people we don't know as well. Research, like that Harvard study on how people find jobs, shows these weak ties are often more important for spreading new information or behaviors across different social clusters.
Why weak ties?
Two reasons, mainly. One, they give access to new social circles and information you wouldn't otherwise encounter. Two, there's a kind of social pressure, peer pressure, almost that comes from weak ties. We often feel obligated to participate or conform when asked by acquaintances, perhaps because the social cost of saying no feels high in terms of maintaining those wider network connections. This pressure helps the habits of participation spread.
Okay, we've covered a lot. The loop, craving, changing routines, belief, keystones, willpower, organizations, movements. Let's bring it back to the listener. We understand the architecture now. What's the big takeaway? What do we do with this?
I think the biggest takeaway is about responsibility. Once you understand how habits work, you gain a certain degree of freedom, but also responsibility.
How so?
Look at the contrasting legal cases mentioned. Brian Thomas, the man who tragically killed his wife during a sleep terror. He was found not guilty because he was deemed unconscious. His actions were driven by the most primitive automatic press of his brain outside conscious control.
Okay.
Compare that to Angie Bachman, the woman addicted to gambling who lost everything. The courts ruled against her, holding her responsible. Why the difference?
Because she was aware.
Essentially, yes. The argument was that she had become aware of her habit loop, the cues, the routine of gambling, the craving, the reward. She understood at some level what was happening, and because she was aware, she had the opportunity and therefore the responsibility to try and change it, to seek help, to put barriers in place. Awareness confers responsibility.
So understanding the loop isn't just academic. Yeah. It actually makes us accountable for trying to change the habits we don't want.
Exactly. Ignorance might be bliss, but awareness demands action, or at least acknowledges the possibility of action.
Okay, so for someone listening who is aware and wants to change a habit, what's the practical toolkit, the step-by-step?
Duhigg lays out a pretty clear four-step framework in the appendix of his book. It's designed to systematically deconstruct and rebuild a habit.
All right, let's walk through it.
Step one, identify the routine. This is usually the most obvious part. What's the specific behavior you want to change? Is it mindlessly eating snacks at your desk, snapping at your kids, procrastinating on work? Just name it clearly.
Okay, know the target behavior. Step two,
experiment with rewards. This is crucial because the routine isn't driven by the action itself, but by the reward it delivers, the craving it satisfies. And that craving might not be what you think.
Like, you think you're craving a cookie, but maybe you're actually craving a break or a social interaction.
Precisely. So you need to experiment.
Yeah.
When the urge for the old routine hits, try swapping in a different potential reward. Maybe walk around the office, chat with a coworker for 5 minutes, eat an apple, do some quick stretches. Then, and this is key, set an alarm for 15 minutes.
Why the alarm?
When the alarm goes off, check in with yourself.
Yep.
Is the original urge still there? If it's gone or significantly faded, then the new reward you just tried likely satisfied the underlying craving. You found the true reward. If the urge is still strong, then that reward wasn't it. Try a different one next time.
Okay, so experiment until you isolate what your brain is really after.
Got it.
Step three,
isolate the cue. Habits are triggered by specific cues. Most cues fall into one of five categories: location, where are you? Time, what time is it? Emotional state, how are you feeling? Other people, who else is around? And immediately preceding action, what did you just do?
So become a detective about the trigger.
Exactly. Every time you feel the urge for the habit you want to change, quickly jot down the answers to those five things. Where am I? What time is it? How do I feel? Who's here? What just happened? Do this for a few days and a pattern will usually emerge. You'll likely find one or two of those categories are consistently present when the urge strikes. That's your cue.
Found the trigger. Okay, final step.
Step four, have a plan. Now you have all the pieces. You know the routine you want to change. You've experimented and understand the true reward craving. You've isolated the specific cue. Now you create a conscious plan. Write it down. When CUE happens, I will perform new routine in order to get the reward I'm craving.
Make it explicit. When it's 3 p.m. and I feel bored cue, I will walk over and chat with Sarah for 5 minutes new routine to get social connection reward.
Perfect. Having that clear, written plan makes it much more likely you'll actually follow through when the cue hits, rather than falling back on the old automatic routine. You're essentially pre-programming the desired behavior.
And one last thing. We should expect this to be messy, right? It's not going to work perfectly the first time.
Oh, absolutely not. Failure is part of the process. Think about smokers. Research shows they often try to quit 7 or more times before they succeed. The key is not to fall into the what the hell effect.
Which is?
That's when you slip up once, eat one cookie when you're on a diet, and then think, ah, what the hell, I've blown it already, and proceed to eat the whole bag. One slip up becomes a total relapse.
So avoid the second mistake.
Right. Treat the slip ups not as failures, but as experiments. Okay, that plan didn't work in that situation. Why not? What was different? How can I adjust the plan for next time? Each attempt gives you more data to refine your understanding of the loop and your strategy. It's about learning and iteration, not perfection.
It reminds me of that quote from William James. He said something like, "All our life, so far as it has definite form, is but a mass of habits, bearing us irresistibly toward our destiny."
It's a powerful thought. Habits are like these channels dug into our minds, and our behavior, our life flows along them.
But the insight from all this research is that those channels aren't fixed forever. We dug them, consciously or unconsciously.
And now that you understand the architecture, the cues, routines, rewards, cravings, the belief needed, you have the tools and maybe the responsibility to start digging new channels, to consciously direct where that water flows.
So the final question for you listening is, are you aware of the channels your life is flowing through? And are you intentionally digging new ones? That's our deep dive for today. Thanks for joining us.